I would be roused soon enough. Not Jamie, though. I had nothing to worry about, no matter what happened. He wouldn't fight today. I unpinned my hair and shook it down over my shoulders, sighing with relief at its looseness. Then I lay down on the cot beside him, close against him. He lay on his stomach. I could see the small muscular swell of his buttocks smooth under the blanket that covered him. On impulse, I laid my hand on his rump and squeezed. "Sweet dreams," I said, "and let the tiredness take me." Chapter 63. Separated forever from my friends and kin. Lieutenant Lord Ellesmere had finally killed a rebel. Several, he thought, though he couldn't be sure of those he'd shot at. Some of them fell, but might only be wounded. He was sure of the man who had attacked one of the British cannon with a party of other rebels. He'd hacked that man half through the body with a cavalry sabre, and he felt a strange numbness in his sword arm for several days after, this making him flex his left hand every few minutes to be sure he could still use it. The numbness wasn't limited to his arm. The days after the battle in the British camp were spent partially in the orderly retrieval of the wounded, the burial of the dead, and in regathering their forces. What forces remained to be gathered? Desertion was rife. There was a constant small stream of furtive departures. One day a whole company of Brunswickers defected. He oversaw more than one burial detail, watching with set face as men and boys, he knew, were consigned to the earth. On the first couple of days they hadn't buried the bodies deep enough and were obliged to listen all night to the howling and snarling of wolves fighting over the carcasses they had dragged from the shallow graves. They reburied what was left the next day, deeper. Fires burned every 100 yards around the camp at night, for American sharpshooters came close in the dark, taking out the pickets. The days were blazingly hot, the nights miserably cold, and no one rested. Burgoyne had issued an order that no officer nor soldier should ever sleep without his clothes, and William hadn't changed his linen in more than a week. It didn't matter what he smelled like, his own reek was undetectable. The men were obliged to be in the lines with their arms an hour before dawn and to remain there until the sun had burned away the fog, to be sure the fog didn't hide Americans ready to attack. The daily bread allowance was cut, salt, pork and flour were running out, and the sutlers lacked tobacco and brandy to the disgruntlement of the German troops. On the good side, the British defences were in splendid order, with two large redoubts built, and 1,000 men sent out to cut trees to open fields of fire for the artillery. And Burgoyne had announced that General Clinton was expected within 10 days with a supporting force, and food, it was to be hoped. All they had to do was wait.
"The Jews wait the Messiah not more than we wait General Clinton," joked Oberleutnant Grunwald,
who had by some miracle survived his wound at Bennington. "Ha, ha," said William. The American camp was in good spirits, more than ready to finish the job they had started. Unfortunately, while the British camp was short of rations, the Americans were short of ammunition and powder. The result was a period of restless stasis, during which the Americans picked constantly at the periphery of the British camp, but could make no real progress. Ian Murray found this tedious in the extreme. And after a token foray in the fog had resulted in a careless companion stepping on a discarded gun spike and puncturing his foot, he decided this was adequate excuse to pay a visit to the hospital tent where Rachel Hunter was assisting her brother. The prospect so animated him, though, that he paid inadequate attention to his own footing in the fog and plunged headfirst into a ravine, striking his head a glancing blow on a rock. Thus it was that two men limped into camp, supporting each other, and made their halting way to the hospital tent. It was busy in the tent. This was not where the battle wounded lay, but where those with trivial afflictions came for treatment. Ian's head wasn't broken, but he was seeing two of everything and closed one eye in hopes that this might help him spot Rachel.
"Hurro!" someone behind him said in open approval. "Munien don boich."
For one head-spinning instant, he thought it was his uncle speaking and blinked stupidly, wondering why Uncle Jamie should be making flirtatious remarks to his aunt while she was working. But Auntie Claire wasn't here at all, his slow wits reminded him. So what? One hand over his eye to keep it from falling out of his head, he turned carefully and saw a man in the opening of the tent. The morning sun struck sparks from the man's hair, and Ian's mouth fell open, feeling that he'd been struck in the pit of the stomach. It wasn't Uncle Jamie, he could see that at once as the man came in, also helping a limping comrade. The face was wrong, red and weather-beaten, with cheerful, snub features. The hair was ginger, not Rufus, and receded sharply from the man's temples. He was solidly built, not terribly tall, but the way he moved, like a catamount, even burdened with his friend, and for some reason Ian couldn't remove the lingering impression of Jamie Fraser. The red-haired man was kilted. They both were. Highlanders, he thought, thoroughly fuddled. But he'd known that from the moment the man spoke.
"Coo-hoo?" Ian asked abruptly. "Who are you?"
Hearing the Gaelic, the man looked at him, startled. He gave Ian a quick up and down, taking in his mohawk dress before answering.
"I am Hamish Mackenzie of Boisdale. Who asks?"
"Ian Murray," he replied, trying to focus his addled wits. The name sounded familiar, but why would it not? He knew hundreds of Mackenzies.
"My grandmother was a Mackenzie," he offered, in the usual way of establishing relations among strangers. "Ellen Mackenzie of Leoch."
The man's eyes sprang wide.
"Ellen of Leoch," cried the man, very excited. "Daughter of him they call Jacob Roy."
In his excitement, Hamish's grip had tightened on his friend, and the man gave a yelp. This attracted the attention of the young woman, the one Hamish had greeted as, "Oh, beautiful nut-brown maiden," and she came hurrying to see the matter. She was nut-brown, Ian saw. Rachel Hunter, tanned by the sun to the exact soft shade of a hickory nut, what showed of her hair beneath her kerchief, the shade of walnut hulls, and he smiled at the thought. She saw him, and narrowed her eyes. "Well, and if thee is able to grin like an ape, thee is not much hurt. Why?" She stopped, astonished at the sight of Ian Murray locked in embrace with a kilted Highlander who was weeping with joy. Ian wasn't weeping, but was undeniably pleased.
"You'll want to meet my Uncle Jamie," he said, adroitly disentangling himself. "Seamus Roy, I think you called him."
James Fraser had his eyes shut, cautiously exploring the pain in his hand. It was sharp-edged, strong enough to make him queasy, but with that deep, grinding ache common to broken bones. Still, it was a healing ache. Claire spoke of bones knitting, and he'd often thought this was more than a metaphor. It sometimes felt that someone was indeed stabbing steel needles into the bone and forcing the shattered ends back into some pattern, heedless of how the flesh around them felt about it. He should look at his hand. He knew that. He had to get used to it, after all. He'd had the one quick glance, and it had left him dizzy and on the point of vomiting out of sheer confoundment. He couldn't reconcile the sight, the feel of it, with the strong memory of how his hand ought to be. He'd done it before, though, he reminded himself. He'd got used to the scars and the stiffness. And yet, he could remember how his young hand had felt, had looked so easy, limber and painless, folded round the handle of a hoe, the hilt of a sword.
Clutching a quill? Well, no.
He smiled ruefully to himself.
That hadn't been either easy or limber, even with his fingers at their unmarred best.
Would he be able to write at all with his hand now? He wondered suddenly. and in curiosity flexed his hand a little. The pain made him gasp, but his eyes were open, fixed on his hand. The disconcerting sight of his little finger pressed close to the middle one did make his belly clench. But his fingers curled. It hurt like Christ crucified, but it was just pain. There was no pull, no stubborn hindrance from the frozen finger. It worked. I mean to leave you with a working hand. He could hear Claire's voice, breathless but sure. He smiled a little.
It didn't do to argue with the woman over any matter medical.
I came into the tent to fetch my small cautery iron and found Jamie sitting on the cot, slowly flexing his injured hand and contemplating his severed finger, which lay on a box beside him. I had wrapped it hastily in a plaster bandage, and it looked like a mummified worm.
I said delicately, I'll dispose of that, shall I? How?
He put out a tentative forefinger, touched it, then snatched back his hand as though the detached finger had moved suddenly. He made a small nervous sound that wasn't quite a laugh. Burn it, I suggested. That was the usual method for disposing of amputated limbs on battlefields, though I had never personally done it. The notion of building a funeral pyre for the cremation of a single finger seemed suddenly absurd, though no more so than the idea of simply tossing it into one of the cook fires and hoping no one noticed. Jamie made a dubious noise in his throat, indicating that he wasn't keen on the idea.
Well, I suppose you could smoke it, I said, with equal dubiety, and keep it in your sporran as a souvenir, like young Ian did with Neil Forbes's ear. Has he still got that, do you know?
Aye, he does.
Jamie's colour was beginning to come back as he regained his self-possession.
But no, I dinna think I want to do that.
I could pickle it in spirits of wine, I offered. That got the ghost of a smile.
10 to 1, someone would drink it before the day was out, Sassenach.
I thought that was generous odds myself. More like 1,000 to 1.
I managed to keep my medicinal alcohol mostly intact only by virtue of having one of Ian's more ferocious Indian acquaintances guard it when I wasn't using it, and sleeping with the keg next to me at night.
Well, I think that leaves burial as the only other option.
Mm-hmm. That sound indicated agreement, but with reservations, and I glanced up at him.
What? I will, he said, rather diffidently. When we Fergus lost his hand, it was Jenny's notion. But we held a bit of a funeral, Ken.
I bit my lip. Well, why not? Will it be a family affair, or shall we invite everyone? Before he could answer this, I heard Ian's voice outside, talking to someone, and an instant later his dishevelled head pushed through the flap. One of his eyes was black and swollen, and there was a sizable lump on his head, but he was grinning from ear to ear.
"Uncle Jamie," he said,
"there's someone here to see you."
"How is it that you've come to be here, Aharich?"
Jamie asked, somewhere after the third bottle. We had had supper long since, and the campfire was burning low. Hamish wiped his mouth and handed the new bottle back.
Here? He repeated. Here in the wilderness, do you mean? Or here, fighting against the king?
He gave Jamie a direct blue look, so like one of Jamie's own that Jamie smiled, recognizing it.
Is the second of those questions the answer to the first? He said.
And Hamish gave him the shadow of a smile in return.
Aye, that would be it. You are always as quick as a hummingbird, Ashimus, in body and mind.
Seeing from my expression that I was perhaps not quite so swift in my perceptions, he turned to me.
It was the king's troops who killed my uncle, the king's soldiers who killed the fighting men of the clan, who destroyed the land, who left the women and the bairns to starve, who battered down my home and exiled me, who killed half the people left to me with cold and hunger and the plagues of the wilderness.
He spoke quietly, but with a passion that burned in his eyes.
I was 11 years old when they came to the castle and put us out. I turned 12 on the day that they made me swear my oath to the king. They said I was a man. And by the time we reached Nova Scotia, I was.
He turned to Jamie.
They made ye swear too, Seamus. They did,
Jamie said softly.
A forced oath canna bind a man, though, or keep him from his knowledge of right.
Hamish put out a hand, and Jamie gripped it, though they didn't look at each other.
No, he said with certainty, that it cannot.
Perhaps not, but I knew they were both thinking, as I was, of the language of that oath. May I lie in an unconsecrated grave, separated forever from my friends and kin. And both thinking, as I was, how great the odds were that that fate was exactly what would happen to them. And to me. I cleared my throat. But the others, I said, impelled by the memory of so many I had known in North Carolina, and knowing the same was true of many in Canada. The Highlanders, who are loyalists?
Aye, well,
Hamish said softly, and looked into the fire, the lines of his face cut deep by its glow.
They fought bravely, but the heart of them was killed. They want only peace now and to be left alone. But war doesn't leave any alone, does it?
He looked suddenly at me, and for a startling instant I saw Dougal Mackenzie looking out of his eyes, that impatient, violent man who had hungered for war. Not waiting for an answer, he shrugged and went on.
War's found them again. They've no choice but to fight. But anyone can see what a pitiful rabble the Continental Army is. Or was.
He lifted his head, nodding a little as though to himself at the sight of the campfires, the tents, the vast cloud of starlit haze that hung above us, full of smoke and dust, and the scent of guns and ordure.
They thought the rebels would be crushed and quickly.
Oaths notwithstanding, who but a fool would join such a risky business? A man who had had no chance to fight before, I thought. He smiled crookedly at Jamie.
I am surprised we were not crushed, he said,
sounding, in fact, faintly surprised.
Are you not surprised as well, Seamus? Amazed,
Jamie said, a faint smile on his own face.
Glad of it, though. And glad of you, Seamus.
They talked through most of the night. When they lapsed into Gaelic, I got up, put a hand on Jamie's shoulder in token of good night, and crawled into my blankets. Exhausted by the day's work, I drifted into sleep at once, soothed by the sound of their quiet talk, like the sound of bees in the heather. The last thing I saw before sleep took me was young Ian's face across the fire, rapt at hearing of the Scotland that had vanished just as he himself was born. Chapter 64. A Gentleman Caller.
Mrs. Fraser?
A pleasant masculine voice spoke behind me, and I turned to see a stocky, broad-shouldered officer in the doorway of my tent, in shirt sleeves and waistcoat, a box cradled in one arm. I am. May I help you? He didn't look sick. In fact, he was healthier looking than most of the army, his face very weathered but well-fleshed and ruddy. He smiled, a sudden charming smile that quite transformed his big beaky nose and heavy brows.
I was in hopes that we might transact a little business, Mrs. Fraser.
He raised one of the bushy brows, and at my gesture of invitation, came into the tent, ducking only a little.
I suppose that depends what you're looking for, I said, with a curious look at his box.
If it's whiskey, I can't give you that, I'm afraid. There was, in fact, a small keg of this valuable substance hidden under the table at the moment, along with a larger keg of my raw medicinal alcohol, and the smell of the latter was strong in the air as I was steeping herbs in it. This gentleman was not the first to have been drawn by the scent. It attracted soldiers of all ranks, like flies.
Oh, no, he assured me, though casting an interested look at the table behind me, where I had several large jars in which I was growing what I hoped was penicillin. I'm told, though, that you possess a stock of cinchona bark. Is that so?
Well, yes. Piece it. I waved him to my patient stool and sat down myself, knee to knee. Do you suffer from malaria?
I didn't think so.
The whites of his eyes were clear. He wasn't jaundiced.
No, may the Lord be thanked for his mercy. I have a gentleman in my command, a particular friend, who does, though, very badly, and our surgeon has no Jesuit bark. I hope that you might be induced, perhaps, to make a trade.
He had laid the box on the table beside us, and at this flipped it open. It was divided into small compartments and contained a remarkable assortment of things. Lace edging, silk ribbon, a pair of tortoiseshell hair combs, a small bag of salt, a pepper box, an enameled snuff box, a pewter brooch in the shape of a lily, several bright hanks of embroidery silk, a bundle of cinnamon sticks, and a number of small jars filled, apparently, with herbs. And a glass bottle whose label read, Laudanum, I exclaimed, reaching for it involuntarily. I stopped myself, but the officer gestured to me to go ahead, and I pulled it carefully from its resting place, drew the cork, and moved the bottle wearily past my nose. The pungent, sickly sweet scent of opium drifted out, a genie in a bottle. I cleared my throat and put the cork back in. He was watching me with interest.
I wasn't sure what might best suit you, he said, waving at the box's contents. I used to run a store, you see. A great deal of apothecary stuff, but luxurious dry goods in general. I learned, in the course of my business, that it is always best to give the ladies a good deal of choice. They tend to be much more discriminating than do the gentlemen.
I gave him a sharp glance, but it wasn't flummery. He smiled at me again, and I thought that he was one of those unusual men, like Jamie, who actually liked women, beyond the obvious. I imagine we can accommodate each other then, I said, returning the smile.
I ought not to ask, I suppose. I don't intend to hold you up.
I'll give you what you need for your friend, but with thought of possible future trade. Have you got more, laudanum? He continued to smile, but his gaze sharpened. He had rather unusual eyes, that pale grey often described as spit-coloured.
Why, yes, he said slowly. I have quite a bit. Do you require it regularly?
It occurred to me that he was wondering whether I was an addict. It wasn't at all uncommon in circles where laudanum was easily obtainable. I don't use it myself, no, I replied equably, and I administer it to those in need with considerable caution. But relief of pain is one of the more important things I can offer some of the people who come to me. God knows I can't offer many of them cure. His brows went up at that.
That's a rather remarkable statement. Most persons in your profession seem to promise cure to nearly everyone.
How does that saying go?
If wishes were horses, beggars might ride.
I smiled, but without much humour.
Everyone wants a cure, and certainly there's no physician who doesn't want to give them one. But there are a lot of things beyond the power of any physician, and while you might not tell a patient that, it's as well to know your own limits. You think so?
He tilted his head, regarding me curiously.
Do you not think that the admission of such limits, a priori, and I do not mean only in the medical way, but in any arena of endeavour, that such an admission in itself establishes limits? That is, might that expectation prevent one from accomplishing all that is possible, because one assumes that something is not possible, and therefore does not strive with all one's power to achieve it?
I blinked at him, rather surprised. Well, yes, I said slowly.
If you put it that way,
I rather think I agree with you. After all, I waved a hand toward the tent flap, indicating the surrounding army. If I didn't,
we didn't, believe that one can accomplish things beyond all reasonable expectation,
would my husband and I be here? He laughed at that.
Brava, ma'am. Yes, an impartial observer would, I think, call this venture sheer madness, and they might be right, he added, with a rueful tilt of the head. But they'll have to defeat us nonetheless. We shan't give up.
I heard voices outside, Jamie talking casually with someone, and in the next moment he had ducked inside the tent.
Sassenach, he began. Can you come and...
He stopped dead, seeing my visitor, and drew up a bit with a formal bow.
Sir?
I glanced back at the visitor, surprised. Jamie's manner made it clear that this was a superior officer of some sort. I'd thought him perhaps a captain or a lieutenant. As for the officer himself, he nodded, friendly but reserved.
Colonel, your wife and I have been discussing the philosophy of endeavour. What do you say? Does a wise man know his limits, or a bold one deny them? And which way do you declare yourself?
Jamie looked mildly startled and glanced at me.
I lifted one shoulder an inch.
Oh, well, he said, switching his attention back to my visitor. I've heard it said that a man's reach must exceed his grasp. Or what's a heaven for?
The officer stared at him for an instant, mouth open, then laughed with delight and slapped his knee.
You and your wife are two of a kind, sir. My kind. That's splendid. Do you recall where you heard it?
Jamie did. He'd heard it from me more than once over the years. He merely smiled and shrugged, though.
A poet, I believe, but I forgot the name. Well, a perfectly expressed sentiment, nonetheless. I mean to go and try it on Granny directly, though I imagine he'll just blink stupidly at me through his spectacles and bleat about supplies. There's a man who knows his limits, he remarked to me, still good-natured, but with a distinct edge in his voice. Knows his own damnably low limits and won't let anyone else exceed them. A heaven's not for the likes of him.
That last remark went beyond edgy. The smile had faded from his face, and I glimpsed a hot anger at the back of his pale eyes. I had a moment of disquiet. Granny could only be General Gates, and this man was plainly a disaffected member of the High Command. I sincerely hoped Robert Browning and I hadn't just landed Jamie in the middle of something. Well, I said, trying to make light of it, they can't defeat you if you won't give up. The shadow that had rested on his brow cleared, and he smiled at me, merry-eyed once more.
Oh, they'll never defeat me, Mrs. Fraser. Trust me.
I will, I assured him, turning to open one of my boxes. Let me get the Jesuit bark for you. I hesitated, not knowing his rank, and he noticed, clapping a hand to his forehead in apology.
My apologies, Mrs. Fraser. What can you think of a man who bursts into your presence, rudely demanding medicaments, and failing even to introduce himself properly?
He took the small package of shredded bark from my hand, retaining the hand itself, and bowed low over it, gently kissing my knuckles.
Major General Benedict Arnold, your servant, ma'am.
Jamie looked after the departing general, a slight frown on his face. Then he glanced back at me, and the frown disappeared instantly.
Are you all right, Sassenach? You look as though you're about to fall over.
I might at that, I said, rather faintly, and groped for my stool. I sat on it and discovered the new bottle of laudanum on the table beside me. I picked it up, finding the solid weight of it a reassurance that I hadn't imagined the gentleman who'd just left us.
I was mentally prepared to run into George Washington or Benjamin Franklin in person at some point, I said. Even John Adams.
But I didn't really expect him. And I liked him, I added ruefully. Jamie's brows were still up, and he glanced at the bottle in my lap as though wondering whether I'd been having a nip.
Why should you not like...
Oh.
His face changed.
You know something about him?
Yes, I do. And it's not something I want to know. I swallowed, feeling a little ill. He's not a traitor yet, but he will be. Jamie glanced back over his shoulder to be sure we were not overheard, then came and sat on the patient stool, taking my hands in his.
Tell me,
he said, low-voiced. There were limits to what I could tell him, and not for the first time I regretted not having paid more attention to Bree's history homework, as that formed the nucleus of my specific knowledge regarding the American Revolution. He fought on the American side for some time and was a brilliant soldier, though I don't know any of the details of that. But at some point he became disillusioned, decided to switch sides, and began making overtures to the British, using a man called Jean André as his go-between. André was captured and hanged, I know that much. But I think Arnold got away to England. For an American general to turn his coat. It was such a spectacular act of treason that the name Benedict Arnold became a synonym for traitor. Will become, I mean. If someone commits some horrible act of betrayal, you call them a Benedict Arnold. The sick feeling hadn't gone away. Somewhere, right this minute, one Major John André was happily going about his business, presumably without the slightest notion of what lay in his future.
When?
Jamie's fingers pressing mine drew my attention away from Major André's impending doom and back to the more urgent matter. That's the problem, I said helplessly. I don't know. Not yet. I think not yet. Jamie thought for a moment, brows drawn down.
I'll watch him then, he said quietly.
Don't, I said by reflex. We stared at each other for a long moment, recalling Charles Stuart. It hadn't escaped either of us that attempting to interfere with history could have serious unintended consequences, if in fact it could be done at all. We had no notion what it was that might turn Arnold from patriot, which he certainly was at the moment, to the traitor he would be. Was his fight with Gates the niggling grain of sand that would form the heart of a treacherous pearl? You don't know what small thing might affect someone's mind, I pointed out. Look at Robert the Bruce and that spider. That made him smile.
I'll gang warily, Sassenach, he said. But I'll watch him.
Chapter 65 Hat Trick, October 7th, 1777.
Well then... Order on Morgan to begin the game.
General Horatio Gates. On a quiet autumn morning, crisp and golden, a British deserter entered the American camp. Burgoyne was sending out a reconnaissance force, he said, 2,000 men, to test the strength of the American right wing.
Granny Gates's eyes nearly popped through his spectacles, Jamie told me, hastily reloading his cartridge box. And nae wonder.
General Arnold, present when the news came, urged Gates to send out a strong force against this foray. Gates, true to form, had been cautious, and when Arnold requested permission to go out and see for himself what the British were about, had given his subordinate a cold look and said,
I am afraid to trust you, Arnold. Matters went rather downhill from there, Jamie said, grimacing slightly. The end of it all was that Gates said to him, and I quote ye exactly, Sassenach. General Arnold, I have nothing for you to do. You have no business here.
I felt a chill that had nothing to do with the temperature of the morning air. Was this the moment? The thing that had, or would, turn Benedict Arnold against the cause he had fought for? Jamie saw what I was thinking, for he lifted one shoulder and said simply,
At least it's nothing to do with us this time.
That is a comfort, I said, and meant it. Take care, will you?
I will,
he said, taking up his rifle. This time he was able to kiss me goodbye in person. The British reconnaissance had a double purpose, not only to see exactly where the Americans were, for General Burgoyne had no real idea, American deserters had stopped coming in long since, but also to acquire much-needed forage for the remaining animals. Consequently, the leading company stopped in a promising wheat field. William sent his infantrymen to sit down in double rows among the standing grain, while the foragers began cutting the grain and loading it on horses. A lieutenant of dragoons, a black-headed Welshman named Absolute, waved from the other side of the field and called him to a game of hazard in his tent in the evening. He had just taken breath to call back when the man beside him let out a gasp and crumpled to the ground. He never heard the bullet, but ducked to the ground, calling out to his men. Nothing further happened, though, and after a few moments they rose cautiously and went about their work. They began to see small parties of rebels, though, stealing through the trees, and William became conscious of a growing conviction that they were being surrounded. When he spoke of this to another officer, though, the man assured him that the rebels had decided to remain behind their defences to be attacked. They were soon undeceived on this point when, in mid-afternoon, a large body of Americans appeared in the woods on their left, and heavy cannon opened up, slamming 6- and 12-pound balls that would have done great damage were it not for the intervening trees. The infantrymen scattered like quail despite the calls of their officers. William caught sight of Absolute pelting down the field through the wheat after a group of his men, and turning, seized a corporal of one of his own companies. "Gather them," he said, and not waiting for an answer, grabbed the bridle of one of the forager's horses, a surprised-looking bay gelding. It was his intent to ride for the main camp for reinforcements, for plainly the Americans were out in force. He never got there, for as he pulled the horse's head around, the brigadier rode onto the field. Jamie Fraser crouched in the grove at the base of the wheat field with a group of Morgan's men taking aim as he could. It was as hot a battle as he'd seen, and the smoke from the cannon in the wood drifted through the field in heavy, choking clouds. He saw the man on the horse, a high-ranking British officer, to judge from his braid. Two or three others, juniors, were near him, also on horseback, but he had eyes only for the one. Grasshoppers flew out of the field like hailstones, panicked by the trampling feet. One struck him in the cheek, buzzing, and he slapped at it, heart thumping, as though it had been a musket ball. He knew the man, though only by his general's uniform. He had met Simon Fraser of Balnain 2 or 3 times, but when they were both lads in the Highlands. Simon was a few years younger, and Jamie's vague memories of a small, round, cheerful wee lad who trotted after the older boys, waving a shinty stick taller than himself, had nothing in common with the stout, solid man who rose now in his stirrups, calling out and brandishing his sword, attempting to rally his panicked troops by sheer force of personality. The aides were urging their mounts round his, trying to shield him, plainly urging him to come away, but he ignored them. Jamie caught a white glimpse of a face turned toward the wood, then away. Plainly they knew the trees were full of riflemen, or could be, and were trying to keep out of range. "There he is!" It was Arnold crashing his small brown mare regardless through the heavy brush, his face alight with savage glee. "The generals!" he bellowed, rising in his own stirrups and throwing out an arm. "Shoot the generals, boys! $5 to the man who shoots yon fat bastard from his saddle." The random crack of rifle fire answered him at once. Jamie saw Daniel Morgan's head turn sharp, eyes fierce at Arnold's voice, and the rifleman started toward him, moving as fast as his rheumatism-crippled limbs would let him. "Again! Try again!" Arnold smote a fist on his thigh, caught sight of Jamie watching him. "You! Shoot him, can't you?" Jamie shrugged, and lifting the rifle to his shoulder, aimed deliberately high and wide. The wind had turned, and the smoke of the shot stung his eyes, but he saw one of the junior officers near Simon jump and clap a hand to his head, twisting in the saddle to see his hat roll away into the wheat. He wanted to laugh, though his wame curled a bit, realizing that he had nearly shot the man through the head entirely by accident. The young man, yes, he was young, tall and thin, rose in his stirrups and shook a fist at the wood.
"You owe me a hat, sir," he shouted.
Arnold's high, piercing laugh echoed through the wood, clear over the shouting, and the men with him hooted and screamed like crows.
"Come over here, Yonker, and I'll buy you two,"
Arnold shouted back, then reined his horse in a restless circle, bellowing at the rifleman.
"Damn your eyes for a crew of blind men! Will nobody kill me, that frigging general?"
One or two shots spattered through the branches, but most of the men had seen Daniel Morgan stumping toward Arnold like an animated tree, gnarled and implacable, and held their fire. Arnold must have seen him too, but ignored him. He jerked a pistol from his belt and fired sideways across his body at Fraser, though he couldn't hope to hit anything at that distance, and his horse, startled at the noise, ears flat back. Morgan, who had nearly reached him, was obliged to jerk back to avoid being trampled. He stumbled and fell flat. Without an instant's hesitation, Arnold leapt off his horse and bent to raise the older man, apologizing with a completely sincere solicitude, which, Jamie saw, was unappreciated by Morgan. He thought old Dan might just give Arnold one in the stones, rank and rheumatism notwithstanding. The general's horse was trained to stand, but the unexpected shot over her ears had spooked her. She was dancing nervously, feet a rattle in the drifts of dead leaves, and eyes showing white. Jamie seized the reins and pulled the mare's nose down, blowing into her nostrils to distract her. She whuffed and shook her head, but ceased to dance. He stroked her neck, clicking his tongue, and her ears rose a bit. His hand was bleeding again, he saw, but it was a slow seep through the bandage, not important. Over the solid curve of the mare's neck, he could see Morgan upright now and violently rejecting Arnold's efforts to dust the leaf mould from his clothes.
"You are relieved of command, sir. How dare you to order my men?"
"Oh, fuck that for a game of soldiers," Arnold said impatient. "I'm a general. He's a general."
He jerked his head toward the distant figure on horseback.
"And I want him dead. Time enough for politics when it's over. This is a fight. Damn it!"
Jamie caught a sudden strong whiff of rum, sweet and fierce under the smell of smoke and trampled wheat.
Aye, well, perhaps that had something to do with it. Though from what he knew of Arnold, there was little enough to choose between the man stone sober and another raving with drink.
The wind came in gusts, hot past his ears, thick with smoke and random sounds, the rattle of muskets punctuated by the crash of artillery to the left, and through it, the shouting of Simon Fraser and his juniors, calling the Hessians and English to rally, the grunts of impact and shrieks of pain from farther away, where the Hessians fought to break through General Enoch Poor's advancing men. General Ebenezer Learned's column was pressing the Hessians from above. Jamie could see the knot of green German uniforms struggling amid a surge of Continentals, but being forced back from the edge of the field. Some were trying to break away to head downfield toward General Fraser. A glimpse of motion drew his eye. The young man he had deprived of a hat was galloping up the field, bent low over his horse's neck, sabre drawn. The general had moved a little away from the wood. He was nearly out of range for most of Morgan's men, but Jamie was well placed. He had a clear shot from here. He glanced down. He had dropped his rifle when he took the horse, but the gun was loaded. He had reloaded by reflex after his first shot. The half-empty cartridge was still folded in the hand that held the reins. Priming would take but an instant.
"Ha, Sanyan,"
he murmured to the horse, and took a deep breath, trying to will himself to calm, will that calmness into the mare, though his hand was throbbing with the rush of his blood. He said under his breath,
"No more. You'll hear nae more to fright ye."
He hadn't even thought about it when he'd fired to miss Fraser. He would kill any other man on the field, but not that one. Then he caught sight of the young soldier on the horse, coat bright red among the thrashing sea of green and blue and homespun, laying about him with his sabre, and felt his mouth twitch.
Not that one, either.
It seemed the young man was having a lucky day. He had cut through Leonard's column at the gallop, taking most of the Continentals unaware, and those who saw him were too much occupied with fighting, or unable to shoot him, because they had discharged their weapons and were fixing bayonets. Jamie stroked the horse absently, whistling gently through his teeth and watching. The young officer had reached the Hessians, had got the attention of some, and was now fighting his way back down the field, a stream of dark green coats in his wake, Hessians at the trot, making for the narrowing gap as Poor's men rushed in from the left. Jamie was so much occupied by this entertaining spectacle that he ignored the shouting match taking place between Dan Morgan and General Arnold. The sound of a whoop from overhead interrupted both.
I got him, by Jesus!
Jamie looked up, startled, and saw Tim Murphy perch in the branches of an oak, grinning like a goblin, the barrel of his rifle snug in a fork. Jamie jerked his head round and saw Simon Fraser slumped and swaying in his saddle, arms folded round his body. Arnold let out a matching whoop, and Morgan glanced up at Murphy, nodding grudging approval.
Good shot, he called.
Simon Fraser was wobbling, about to fall. One of his aides reached for him, shouting desperately for help. Another reined his horse to and fro, undecided where to go, what to do. Jamie clenched his fist, felt a jolt of pain shoot through his maimed hand, and stopped, palm flat on the saddle.
Was Simon dead?
He couldn't tell. The aides had overcome their panic. Two of them rode close on either side, supporting the slumping figure, fighting to keep him in the saddle, heedless of the cheering from the wood. He glanced up the field, searching for the young man with the sabre. He couldn't find him, and felt a small stab of loss. Then picked him up, engaged in a hand-to-hand with a mounted militia captain. No kind of finesse in that sort of fight. It was as much the horse as the man, and as he watched, the horses were forced apart by the crush of bodies round them. The British officer didn't try to force his mount back. He had a goal in mind and shouted and gestured, urging on the small company of Hessians he had extracted from the melee above. Then he turned back toward the wood and saw what was happening. General Fraser's horse being urged away, the general's swaying body, a splotch of red against the trampled wheat. The young man stood in his stirrups for an instant, dropped and spurred his horse toward the general, leaving his Hessians to follow as they might. Jamie was close enough to see the darker crimson of the blood that soaked the middle of Simon Fraser's body.
If Simon wasn't dead already, he thought, it wouldn't be long.
Grief and fury at the waste of it burned in his throat. Tears from the smoke were already running down his cheeks. He blinked and shook his head violently to clear his eyes. A hand jerked the reins unceremoniously from his fingers, and Arnold's stocky body brushed him away from the mare in a gust of rum. Arnold swung up into the saddle, face red as the scarlet maple leaves with excitement and victory.
"Follow me, boys," he shouted.
And Jamie saw that the wood was aswarm with militia, companies Arnold had collected on his mad dash for the battlefield.
"To the redoubt!"
The men cheered and rushed after him, breaking branches and stumbling in their eagerness.
"Follow that goddamn fool," Morgan said shortly,
and Jamie glanced at him in surprise. Morgan scowled at Arnold's back.
"He'll be court-martialed, mark my words," the old rifleman said. "He'd best have a good witness. You're it, James. Go."
Without a word, Jamie seized his rifle from the ground and set off at a run, leaving the wood with its gentle rain of gold and brown. Following Arnold's broad-shouldered, whooping form, his waving hat, into the wheat. They did follow him, a bellowing horde, an armed rabble. Arnold was mounted, but his horse found it heavy going, and the men were not hard-pressed to keep up. Jamie saw the back of Arnold's blue coat, blotched black with sweat, moulded like a rind to the burly shoulders. One shot from the rear, the confusion of battle. But it was no more than a passing thought, gone in an instant. Arnold was gone, too, with a whoop, spurring his mare up and around past the redoubt. Jamie assumed he must be meaning to ride in from the rear, suicide, as the place was crawling with German grenadiers. He could see their mitred hats poking up above the walls of the redoubt. Perhaps Arnold meant to commit suicide, perhaps only to create a diversion for the men attacking the redoubt from the front, with his own death an acceptable price to be paid for it. The redoubt itself stood 15 feet high, a packed earthen wall with a palisade of logs built atop it. And between earth and palisade were abatis, logs sharpened to a point and flung down, pointing outward. Balls were spattering the field before the redoubt, and Jamie ran, dodging bullets he couldn't see. He scrabbled with his feet, clawing for purchase on the logs of the abatis, got one hand through a gap and onto a log, but lost his grip on the flaking bark and fell back, landing bruisingly on his rifle and knocking out his wind. The man beside him fired up through the gap, and white smoke spurted over him, hiding him momentarily from the Hessian he glimpsed above. He rolled over and crawled away fast before the smoke could drift off, or the fellow decided to drop a grenade through it. "Get clear!" he shouted over his shoulder, but the man who'd fired was trying his own luck with a running jump. The grenade fell through the gap just as the man leapt upward. It caught him in the chest and went off. Jamie rubbed his hand on his shirt, swallowing bile. The skin of his palm stung, scraped, and full of bark splinters. Shards of metal and wood chips had exploded outward. Something had struck Jamie in the face, and he felt the sting of his sweat and the warmth of blood running down his cheek. He could see the grenadier, a glimpse of green coat through the gap in the abatis. Quick, before he moved. He grabbed a cartridge from his bag and ripped it with his teeth, counting. He could load a rifle in 12 seconds. He knew it. Had timed it. 9, 8. What was it Bree taught the Wains, counting seconds? Hippopotami. 6 hippopotami. 5 hippopotami. He had an insane urge to laugh, seeing in his mind's eye a group of several hippopotami solemnly watching him and making critical remarks regarding his progress. 2 hippopotami. He wasn't dead yet, so he pressed himself close up under the abatis, aimed the barrel through the gap, and fired at the smear of green that might be a fir tree, but wasn't, since it screamed. He slung the rifle onto his back and once more leapt, fingers digging desperately into the unpeeled log. They slipped, splinters running up under his nails, and pain shot through his hand like lightning, but now he had his other hand up, grabbed his right wrist with his sound left hand, and locked his grip round the log. His feet slid on the loose-packed dirt, and for an instant he swung free, like a squirrel hanging from a tree branch. He pulled upward against his weight and felt something tear in his shoulder, but couldn't stop to favour it. A foot. He had his foot braced on the underside of the log now. A wild swing with his free leg, and he was clinging like a sloth. Something chunked into the log he clung to. He felt the shiver through the wood.
"Hold on, Red!"
someone screamed below him, and he froze. Another chunking sound, and something came down on the wood an inch from his fingers. An axe? He didn't have time to be scared. The man below fired past his shoulder. He heard the ball whiz past, buzzing like an angry hornet, and he pulled himself toward the base of the log in a rush, hand over hand, as fast as he could, worming his way between the logs, clothes ripping and his joints too. There were 2 Hessians lying just above his gap, dead or wounded. Another, 10 feet away, saw his head pop through and reached into his sack, teeth bared beneath a waxed moustache. A blood-curdling yell came from behind the Hessian, though, and one of Morgan's men brought down a tomahawk on his skull. He heard a noise, and turned in time to see a corporal step on one of the Hessian bodies, which abruptly came to life, rolling up with musket in hand. The Hessian struck up with all his force, the blade of the bayonet ripping up through the corporal's breeches as he stumbled, tearing free in a spray of blood. By reflex, Jamie seized his rifle by the barrel and swung it, the motion snapping through his shoulders, arms and wrists as he tried to drive the butt through the man's head. The jolt of collision wrenched his arms, and he felt the bones of his neck pop and his sight go white. He shook his head to clear it and smeared sweat and blood from his eye sockets with the heel of his hand. Shit, he'd bent the rifle. The Hessian was dead for good, a look of surprise on what was left of his face. The wounded corporal was crawling away, one leg of his breeches soaked with blood, his musket slung onto his back, his own bayonet blade in his hand. He glanced over his shoulder and, seeing Jamie, shouted, "Rifleman, you're back!" He didn't turn to see what it was, but dived headlong and to the side, rolling into leaves and trampled earth. Several bodies rolled over him in a grunting tangle and crashed against the palisades. He got up slowly, took one of the pistols from his belt, cocked it, and blew out the brains of a grenadier poised to throw one of his grenades over the edge. A few more shots, groans and thumps, and as quickly as that, the fight died down. The redoubt was littered with bodies, most of them green-clad. He caught a glimpse of Arnold's little mare, white-eyed and limping, riderless. Arnold was on the ground, struggling to stand. Jamie felt nearly unable to stand himself. His knees had gone to water and his right hand was paralyzed, but he wobbled over to Arnold and half fell down beside him. The general had been shot. His leg was all over blood, and his face was white and clammy, his eyes half closing from the shock. Jamie reached out and gripped Arnold's hand, calling his name to pull him back, thinking even as he did so that this was madness. He should slip his dirk into the man's ribs and spare both him and the victims of his treachery. But the choice was made and passed before he had time to think about it. Arnold's hand tightened on his.
"Where?"
Arnold whispered. His lips were blanched.
"Where am I hit?"
"It's your leg, sir," Jamie said. "The same where you were hit before."
Arnold's eyes opened and fixed upon his face.
"I wish it had been my heart," he whispered,
and closed them again. Chapter 66 Deathbed. A British ensign came just after nightfall, under a flag of truce. General Gates sent him to our tent. Brigadier Simon Fraser had learned of Jamie's presence and wished to see him.
"Before it's too late, sir," the ensign said, low-voiced.
He was very young and looked shattered.
"Will you come?"
Jamie was already rising, though it took him two tries to get up. He wasn't hurt beyond a number of spectacular bruises and a sprained shoulder, but he hadn't had the strength even to eat when he staggered back after the battle. I'd washed his face for him and given him a glass of beer. He was still holding it undrunk and now set it down.
"My wife and I will come," he said hoarsely.
I reached for my cloak and, just in case, my kit. I needn't have bothered with the kit. General Fraser lay on a long dining table in the main room of a large log cabin, the Baroness von Riedesel's house, the little ensign had murmured, and it was apparent from a glance that he was beyond any aid I could offer. His broad face was almost bloodless in the candlelight, and his body was wrapped in bandages, these soaked with blood. Fresh blood, too. I saw the wet patches slowly spreading, darker than the patches of dried blood already there. Absorbed by the dying man, I'd only dimly registered the presence of several other people in the room, and had consciously noted only two, the surgeons who stood near the bed, blood-stained and white-faced with fatigue. One of them darted a glance at me, then stiffened a little. His eyes narrowed and he nudged his fellow, who looked up from his contemplation of General Fraser, frowning. He looked at me with no particular comprehension and went back to his fruitless meditation. I gave the first surgeon a straight look, but without any hint of confrontation. I didn't mean to intrude on his territory. There was nothing I could do here. Nothing anyone could do, as the surgeon's exhausted attitudes clearly showed. The second man hadn't given up, and I admired him for it. But the scent of putrefaction in the air was unmistakable, and I could hear the general's breathing, long, stertorous sighs with a nerve-wringing silence between them. There was nothing I could do for General Fraser as a doctor, and there were people here who could offer better comfort than I could. Jamie, perhaps, among them. "He hasn't long," I whispered to Jamie. "If there's anything you want to say to him." He nodded, swallowing, and went forward. A British colonel at the side of the impromptu deathbed narrowed his eyes, but at a murmur from another officer stepped back a little so that Jamie could approach. The room was small and very crowded. I kept back, trying to stay out of the way. Jamie and the British officer murmured together for a moment. A young officer, no doubt the general's aide, knelt in the shadow on the far side of the table, holding the general's hand, his own head bowed in obvious distress. I pushed the cloak back over my shoulders. Cold as it was outside, the air inside was beastly hot, unhealthy and suffocating, as though the fever that was devouring General Fraser before our eyes had risen from the bed and spread through the cabin, unsatisfied with its meagre prey. It was a miasma, thick with decaying bowels, stale sweat, and the taste of black powder that hung in the men's clothes. Jamie bent, then knelt himself to come closer to Fraser's ear. The general's eyes were closed, but he was conscious. I saw his face twitch at the sound of Jamie's voice. His head turned, and his eyes open, the dullness in them brightening momentarily in recognition. Jamie asked softly,
"How are you, cousin?"
The general's mouth twitched a little. He replied hoarsely,
"I have the devil of an indigestion. I must have eaten something that disagreed with me."
The British officer stirred a little, hearing the Gaelic, and the young officer on the far side of the bed looked up, startled. Not nearly as startled as I was. The shadowed room seemed to shift around me, and I half fell against the wall, pressing my hands against the wood in hopes of finding something solid to hold on to. Sleeplessness and grief lined his face, and it was still grimed with smoke and blood, smeared raccoon-like across his brow and cheekbones by a careless sleeve. None of that made the slightest difference. His hair was dark, his face narrower, but I would have known that long, straight nose and those slanted blue cat eyes anywhere. He and Jamie knelt on either side of the general's deathbed, no more than 5 feet apart. Surely no one could fail to see the resemblance if...
Ellesmere.
A captain of infantry stepped forward and touched the young man's shoulder with a murmured word and a small jerk of the head, plainly telling him to leave the general's side in order to give General Fraser a moment's privacy should he desire it. "Don't look up," I thought as fiercely as I could in Jamie's direction. "For God's sake, don't look up." He didn't. Whether he had recognized the name or caught a glimpse of that soot-smeared face across the bed, he kept his own head bent, his features hid in shadow, and leaned nearer, speaking very low to his cousin Simon. The young man rose to his feet, slow as Dan Morgan on a cold morning. His shadow wavered on the rough-cut logs behind him, tall and spindly. He was paying no attention to Jamie. Every fibre of his being was focused on the dying general.
"It is gladness to be seeing you once more on earth, Seamus MacBrien," Fraser whispered, bringing both his hands across with an effort to clasp Jamie's. "I am content to die among my comrades, whom I love. But you will tell this to those of our blood in Scotland. Tell them
One of the other officers spoke to William, and he turned reluctantly away from the bedside, answering low-voiced. My fingers were damp with sweat, and I could feel beads of perspiration running down my neck. I wanted desperately to take off my cloak, but feared to make any movement that might draw William's attention to me and thus toward Jamie. Jamie was still as a rabbit under a bush. I could see his shoulders tight under the damp, dark coat, and his hands gripping the general's, and only the flicker of the firelight on the ruddy crown of his head gave any illusion of movement.
"It shall be as you say, Shimi Makshimi."
I could barely hear his whisper.
"Lay your wish upon me. I will bear it."
I heard a loud sniff beside me and glanced aside to see a small woman, dainty as a porcelain doll despite the hour and the circumstance. Her eyes shone with unshed tears. She turned her head to dab at them, saw me watching, and gave me a tremulous attempt at a smile.
"I am so glad that your husband is come, madam," she whispered to me in a soft German accent. It is a comfort, perhaps, that our dear friend shall have the solace of a kinsman by his side."
Two of them, I thought, biting my tongue, and by an effort of will didn't look in William's direction. The awful thought came suddenly to me that William might recognize me and make some effort to come and speak with me, which might well mean disaster if... The Baroness, for she must be von Riedesel's wife, seemed to sway a little, though it might be only an effect of the shifting firelight and the press of bodies. I touched her arm. "I need air," I whispered to her. "Come outside with me." The surgeons were drifting back toward the bed intent as vultures, and the Gallic murmurings were broken suddenly by a terrible groan from Simon Fraser.
"Bring a candle,"
one of the surgeons said sharply, moving quickly toward the bedside. The Baroness's eyes shut tight, and I saw her throat move as she swallowed. I took her hand and led her quickly out. It wasn't long, but seemed an age before the men came out, heads bowed. There was a short, sharp argument outside the cabin, conducted in low voices by reason of respect for the dead, but nonetheless heated. Jamie kept to one side, with his hat on, pulled well down, but one of the British officers turned to him now and then, obviously requesting his opinion. Lieutenant William Ransom, a.k.a. Lord Ellesmere, kept to himself too, as befitted his relatively lowly rank in this company. He didn't join in the argument, seeming too much shocked by the death. I wondered whether he had seen anyone he knew die before, and then realized how idiotic that thought was. But battlefield deaths, however violent, are not the same as the death of a friend. And from the looks of young William, Simon Fraser had been friend as well as commander to him. Occupied by these surreptitious observations, I hadn't been paying more than the most cursory attention to the main point of the argument, that being the immediate disposition of General Fraser's body, and none at all to the two medical men who had come out of the cabin and now stood a little apart, murmuring to each other. From the corner of my eye, I saw one reach into his pocket and hand the other a twist of tobacco, wave off the other's thanks, then turn away. What he said, though, seized my attention as effectively as though his head had burst into flame.
"See you a bit later, then, Dr. Rawlings," he'd said.
"Dr. Rawlings?" I said by reflex, and the second doctor turned.
"Yes, ma'am,"
he said politely, but with the air of an exhausted man struggling against an overwhelming urge to tell the world to go to hell. I recognized the impulse and sympathized, but having spoken, had no choice but to continue. "I beg your pardon," I said, flushing a little. "I just caught your name and was struck by it. I used to know a Dr. Rawlings." The effect of this casual remark was unexpected. His shoulders drew back abruptly, and his dull gaze sharpened into eagerness.
"You did? Where?"
I floundered for a moment, as in fact I had never actually met Daniel Rawlings, though I certainly felt I knew him, and temporized by saying, "His name was Daniel Rawlings. Would that perhaps be a relative of yours?" His face lighted up and he seized me by the arm. "Yes, yes, he is my brother. Pray tell me, ma'am, do you know where he is?" I had a nasty sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. I did, in fact, know exactly where Daniel Rawlings was, but the news wasn't going to be welcome to his brother. There was no choice, though. I had to tell him. "I'm terribly sorry to have to tell you that he's dead," I said, as gently as I could. I put my own hand over his and squeezed, my throat constricting again as the light in his eyes died. He stood unmoving for the space of several breaths, his eyes focused somewhere beyond me. Slowly, they refocused on me, and he took one more deep breath and firmed his mouth.
"I see. I had feared that. How did it happen, do you know?"
"I do," I said hurriedly, seeing Colonel Grant shift his weight in a manner indicating imminent departure. "But it's a long story."
"Ah."
He caught the direction of my glance and turned his head. All the men were moving now, straightening their coats, putting on their hats as they exchanged a few final words.
"I'll find you," he said abruptly, turning back to me. "Your husband, he is a tall Scottish rebel. I think they said he is kin to the general."
I saw his gaze flick momentarily towards something beyond me, and alarm pricked like needles in my skin. Rawlings' brows were slightly knitted, and I knew, as clearly as if he had spoken, that the word kin had triggered some connection in his mind, and that he was looking at William.
"Yes, Colonel Fraser,"
I said hurriedly, grasping him by the sleeve before he could look at Jamie and complete the thought that was forming. I had been groping in my kit as we spoke, and at this point found the folded square of paper I'd been looking for. I pulled it out and, unfolding it quickly, handed it to him. There was still room for doubt, after all.
"Is this your brother's hand?"
He seized the paper from me and devoured the small, neat script with an expression in which eagerness, hope, and despair were mingled. He closed his eyes for an instant, then opened them, reading and rereading the receipt for Bowelbind as if it were holy writ.
"The page is burned," he said, touching the singed edge.
His voice was husky.
"Did Daniel die in a fire?"
"No," I said. "There was no time." One of the British officers stood impatiently behind him, waiting. I touched the hand that held the page.
"Keep that, please. And if you can manage to cross the lines, I suppose you can now, you'll find me most easily in my tent near the artillery park. They call me the White Witch," I added diffidently. "Ask anyone."
His bloodshot eyes widened at that, then narrowed as he examined me closely. But there was no time for further questions. The officer stepped forward and muttered something in Rawlings' ear with no more than a cursory glance in my direction.
"Yes," Rawlings said. "Yes, certainly."
He bowed to me deeply.
"Your servant, madam. I'm very much obliged to you. May I..."
He lifted the paper, and I nodded.
"Yes, of course. Please keep it."
The officer had turned, obviously intent on chivying another errant member of his party, and with a brief glance at his back, Dr. Rawlings stepped close and touched my hand.
"I'll come," he said, low-voiced, "as soon as I may. Thank you."
He looked up then at someone behind me, and I realized that Jamie had finished his business and come to fetch me. He stepped forward and, with a brief nod to the doctor, took my hand.
"Where is your hat, Lieutenant Ransom?"
The colonel spoke behind me, quietly reproving, and for the second time in 5 minutes I felt the hair stand up on the back of my neck. Not at the colonel's words, but at the murmured reply.
"Rebel Horson shot it off my head," said a voice.
It was an English voice, young, hoarse with suppressed grief, and tinged with anger. Other than that, it was Jamie's voice, and Jamie's hand tightened so abruptly on mine that he nearly crushed my fingers. We were at the trailhead that led upward from the river. Two more steps would see us safely into the shelter of the fog-veiled trees. Instead of taking those two steps, Jamie stopped dead for the space of a heartbeat, then dropped my hand, turned on his heel, and taking the hat off his head, strode over and thrust it into Lieutenant Ransom's hands.
"I believe I owe ye a hat, sir,"
he said politely, and turned away at once, leaving the young man blinking at the battered tricorn in his hands. Glancing back, I caught a glimpse of William's baffled face as he looked after Jamie, but Jamie was propelling me up the path as though Red Indians were at our heels, and a stand of fir saplings hid the lieutenant from view within seconds. I could feel Jamie vibrating like a plucked violin string, and his breath was coming fast. "Have you quite lost your mind?" I inquired conversationally.
"Very likely."
"What on earth?" I began. But he only shook his head and pulled me along until we were well out of both sight and hearing of the cabin. A fallen log that has so far escaped the woodcutters lay half across the path, and Jamie sat down suddenly on this and put a shaking hand to his face. "Are you all right? What on earth is the matter?" I sat beside him and put a hand on his back, beginning to be worried.
"I dinna ken whether to laugh or to weep, Sassenach,"
he said. He took his hand away from his face, and I saw that, in fact, he appeared to be doing both. His lashes were wet, but the corners of his mouth were twitching.
"I've lost a kinsman and found one, all in the same moment. And a moment later, realize that for the second time in my life, I've come within an inch of shooting my son."
He looked at me and shook his head, quite helpless between laughter and dismay.
"I shouldn't have done it, I ken that. It's only, I thought all at once, what if I dinna miss a third time? And I thought I must just speak to him, as a man, in case it should be the only time, aye?"
Colonel Grant cast a curious look at the trailhead where a trembling branch marked the passage of the rebel and his wife, then turned his gaze on the hat in William's hands.
"What the devil was that about?"
William cleared his throat.
"Evidently, Colonel Fraser was the rebel horseman who deprived me of my hat during the battle yesterday," he said, hoping for a tone of dry detachment. "He has recompensed me."
A hint of humour came into Grant's strained face.
"Really? Decent of him."
He peered dubiously at the object in question.
"Has it got lice, do you think?"
In another man, at another time, this might have been interpreted as calumny. But Grant, while more than ready to denigrate the colonial's courage, abilities, and dispositions, clearly intended the question only as a practical discovery of fact. Most of the English and Hessian troops were crawling with lice, and so were the officers. William tilted the hat, scrutinizing it as well as the dim light allowed. The thing was warm in his hands, but nothing moved along the seams.
"Don't think so."
"Well, put it on then, Captain Ransom. We must show a good example to the men, you know."
William had, in fact, assumed the object, feeling slightly queer at the warmth of it on his head before properly hearing what Grant had said.
"Captain,"
he said faintly.
"Congratulations,"
Grant said, the ghost of a smile lightening the exhaustion on his face.
"The Brigadier..."
He glanced back at the reeking, silent cabin, and the smile faded.
"He wanted you made captain after Ticonderoga. Should have been done then, but, well..."
His lips thinned, but then relaxed.
"General Burgoyne signed the order late last night, after hearing several accounts of the battle. I gather that you distinguished yourself."
William ducked his head awkwardly. His throat was thick and his eyes burned. He couldn't remember what he'd done, only that he'd failed to save the Brigadier.
"Thank you,"
he managed, and couldn't keep from glancing back himself. They had left the door open.
"Do you know, did he..." "No, it doesn't matter.
Did he know?
Grant said gently. I told him. I brought the order. Unable to speak, William bobbed his head. The hat, for a wonder, fit him and stayed in place.
God, it's cold,
Grant said softly. He tugged his coat closer, glancing round at the dripping trees and the fog that lay thick among them. The others had gone back to their duties, leaving them alone.
What a desolate place. Terrible time of day, too.
Yes. William felt a momentary relief at being able to admit his own sense of desolation, though the hour and the place had little to do with it. He swallowed, glancing back at the cabin. The open door bothered him. While the fog lay as heavy as a feather bed on the forest, the mist near the cabin was rising, drifting around the windows, and he had the uneasy fancy that it was somehow coming for the brigadier.
I'll just close that door, shall I?
He'd started for the cabin, but was arrested by Grant's gesture.
No, don't.
William glanced at him in surprise, and the colonel shrugged, trying to make light of it.
The donor of your hat said we must leave it open. Some Highland fancy. Something about the soul requiring an exit,
he said delicately.
And at least it's too bloody cold for the flies, he added,
with no delicacy at all. William's shriveled stomach clenched, and he swallowed the bitterness that rose in the back of his throat at the vision of swarming maggots.
But surely we can't...
How long? He demanded.
Not long, Grant assured him. We're only waiting for a burial detail.
William stifled the protest that rose to his lips. Of course. What else could be done? And yet the memory of the trenches they had dug by the heights, the dirt freckling his corporal's cold, round cheeks. After the last 10 days he would have thought himself beyond sensitivity to such things. But the sounds of the wolves that came to eat the dying and the dead echoed suddenly in the hollow pit of his stomach. With a muttered excuse, he stepped aside into the wet shrubbery and threw up as quietly as he could. Wept a little, silent, then wiped his face with a handful of wet leaves and came back. Grant tactfully affected to believe William had simply gone to relieve himself and made no inquiries.
An impressive gentleman, he remarked casually. The general's kinsman, I mean. Wouldn't think they were related to look at, would you?
Caught up in dying hope and tearing grief, William had barely noticed Colonel Fraser before the latter had so suddenly given him the hat, and had been too startled to notice much about him then. He shook his head in agreement, though, having a vague recollection of a tall figure kneeling down by the bed, the firelight touching the crown of his head briefly with red.
"Looks more like you than like the brigadier,"
Grant added offhandedly, then laughed, a painful creak.
"Sure you haven't a Scottish branch in your family?"
No.
Yorkshiremen back to the flood on both sides, save one French great-grandmother,
William replied, grateful for the momentary distraction of light conversation.
My stepfather's mother is half-Scotch. That count, you think?
Whatever Grant might have said in reply was lost as the sound of a doomed soul came down to them through the gloom. Both men froze, listening. The brigadier's piper was coming, with Balcarres and some of his rangers. The burial detail. The sun had risen, but was invisible, blocked by cloud and the canopy of trees. Grant's face was the same colour as the fog, pale, sheened with moisture. The sound seemed to come from a great distance, and yet from the forest itself. Then wails and ululating shrieks joined the piper's lament. Balcarres and his Indians. Despite the chilling sounds, William was a little comforted. It would not be just a hasty field burial, undertaken without regard or respect.
Sound like howling wolves, don't they? Muttered Grant.
He ran a hand down his face, then fastidiously wiped his wet palm on his thigh.
Yes, they do, said William.
He took a firm stance, and waited to receive the mourners, conscious all the time of the cabin at his back, its door standing silent, open to the mist.